Sit back in your seats, get something to eat, and watch this movie. Don't let the kiddies see it, because, well, we'll let you hear the beginning first. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to Left of the Projector. I am your host, Evan, back again with another film discussion from the left. This week we're delving into something I've wanted to discuss for a long time, and that is Soviet cinema. It's hard to believe I've gone almost 100 episodes without getting to some of these classic masterpieces out of the Soviet Union, but we will correct that omission today by discussing one of the most famous films in Soviet history, and that is Solaris, directed by Andrei Tarkovsky. And to discuss this truly stunning work of art, I'm joined by Amanda, who you may know from past episodes such as Knives Out, among others. And for the first time in the program, I'm honored to have Brett O'Shea, host of Rev Left Radio, Guerrilla History, Shoeless in South Dakota. All of these, especially Rev Left, I have to say that it was kind of opened my eyes as I was reading and learning about the left. So honored to have you on, and thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on.
I asked you, Brett, to kind of pick a movie. So in full disclosure, I usually send out guests a list of movies from anything from like, you know, more, you know, random comedies to more serious films. And you immediately chose Solaris. I'm wondering what, you know, maybe drew you to pick it and, you know, if you have any history with these kinds of films.
Sure. Yeah. No, I've had periods in my life where I, you know, get more or less into, you know, various forms of art, and film has been something that's been with me since, you know, I came into adulthood. So I've had my Kubrick phases. I've had my film noir phases, my Hitchcock phases, where I kind of dive into all those things. And when you're interested in that stuff, you know, you'll come across things that talk about the best directors of all time or movies that are kind of like this, etc. Especially when you're delving into Kubrick, the Tarkovsky comes up over and over again. And so he's always been high on my list of a director that I wanted to explore. There's the Soviet element, which I found fascinating as well for my own, obviously, political and historical interest reasons. And so I've always wanted to, but have never committed to it, never dove into it. And when you reached out and said you wanted to do a film and gave me that wonderful list of all these awesome films, it just jumped out at me immediately. And like, I was, you know, here's my chance to dive into Tarkovsky. And after watching Solaris, I loved it. And now I'm incredibly excited to continue to watch Tarkovsky's films and hopefully watch all of them, you know, over the next year or so, because I absolutely loved it. So because of you, I'm now getting into Tarkovsky, watch my first Tarkovsky film, and hopefully it's nowhere near my last. So thank you.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I too have watched some Soviet movies. This was the first time I watched a Tarkovsky movie all the way through. I once tried to watch Solaris and just didn't make it through. And like I said, Amanda, you and I have been discussing doing a Soviet movie, you know, for a while. And then you mentioned that you had done a class at school talking about Soviet films. So I don't know if you, was this the first time you'd seen this? And I don't know if you wanted to also, you know, maybe give some of the background on this class and, you know, what made it fun for you?
Yeah. Well, this is the first time that I've seen Tarkovsky's films. Well, that's a lie. Actually, I did watch Stalker, a lot slower pace than I'm used to. That's probably another one of like more famous films. But the class that I took was mostly just like focused on the correlation of Soviet history through the phases of the Soviet Union and how film really influenced a lot of that. Early Soviet cinema, of course, is, you know, silent films about like strikes and, you know, taking over the White Palace and stuff like that. And it kind of goes into like the industry of how they were able to build up the Soviet film industry. And so it was mostly like the class is mostly focused on like narrative rather than the art form of Soviet cinema, which is kind of a miss, but I mean, with a 10-week term, it's kind of hard to cover everything.
Maybe a good starting point to think about the Soviet industry versus, I guess you could call it, the Western American film industry as it was coming up in the 20th century. I kind of maybe separate from some of European film because I think it was a little bit maybe more of a, there was more of an art form within in the Europe, you know, Italian cinema. You can look at lots of directors there, but in looking at this movie as more of a art form, I mean, for anyone out there listening who had a chance to watch it before listening, you probably noticed immediately at the beginning of this movie, there is over 4 minutes of action that's happening. A very simple, beautiful camera work, sounds can being conveyed before you even get to a single line of dialogue. And I know, and I hate to do this, but throughout the episode, we're probably going to slightly lean on the Stanley Kubrick 2001 film from 4 years before 1968, because Tarkovsky really was looking at this movie, Solaris, as a bit of a response on his end to creating a science fiction movie that was different from the way that the American director Stanley Kubrick was creating it. So I guess leads me into maybe two questions is sort of, how did you feel as you were sort of watching the beginning of this movie? And did it have kind of evoke something, which did for me, as a very different feeling than when I turn on even a more arty American movie, whether it's a modern one or a Kubrick film? It just had this feeling that was impossible for me to not feel as I'm seeing the water flowing in this sort of pond, and you have the sound of the leaves crumbling under the feet of the character we haven't even learned about yet, and the horse running through. It is just impossible to escape the work of art that you're watching. And so I'm wondering how you both maybe felt as you were watching this. I know that's maybe a hard thing to put your finger on, but I think in a movie like this, there is a sense of emotion that's being evoked that is different than most films that probably the average American audience.
To begin with, we're recording, I think, January 14th. So I don't know. People living in the Midwest will know that over the last couple of days, we had an incredible amount of snowfall, frigid temperatures. Yesterday, a negative 30 here in Omaha with the wind chill. So when I watched this film, I had this wonderful little experience of watching it during a blizzard. So I was by myself in my cold room with my little space heater, you know, the snow beating on my window and piling up on my windowsill as I'm watching this film, which really put me in an interesting headspace, a perfect headspace to sort of engage with this film. I posted about it on my personal Instagram story where I said, you know, I just started watching this with the blizzard beating on my window and I feel nostalgic for something I can't articulate or understand. And that's the sort of feeling and mood that sort of descended upon me as I watched this film. And the opening shots are hypnotic, you know, and maybe we'll get to this, but one of the many themes that Tarkovsky explores in this film is in some sense our alienation from nature. And to immerse us in nature, to remind us of the beauty of nature, to remind us that we are nature, right? We bubble up out of nature. And we're alienated from nature insofar as we're alienated from ourselves. And that's an interesting theme that plays throughout this film. But I found the overall film to be, you know, sort of disorienting in some ways, hypnotic, certainly existential. I saw it as like a haunting portrayal in part of loss and grief and literal alienation. Like, you know, you're going to an alien planet with an alien life form. It couldn't be more, on the nose with regards to that. But, you know, so there's gorgeous visual aesthetics, which Tarkovsky is known for, and telling a story through, you know, visual artistic expression. And of course, visual art itself plays a huge role in the film. You know, there's these famous portraits, one of which is, Hunters in the Snow, that famous painting. I had a wonderful opportunity the last summer to go to Vienna, Austria for free because I couldn't afford to do it myself, and to go into a museum and see that painting in real life. So I saw original version of that painting like 6, 7, 8 months ago. And, you know, the blizzard's happening outside my window. And again, that's the piece of art that Hari, the sort of apparition, the neutrino composed figure, becomes human staring into that piece of artwork. Which I found, interesting. Another element is the sparse, I don't know how you say that, sparse soundscape. You know, it's with a few exceptions, like when you're in the Japanese highway for fucking 30 minutes straight, it's very loud, you know, but for the most part, even walking through nature, there's only a couple birds chirping. In space, it's very quiet. And I think that speaks to another aspect of this film, which, might not be talked about as much as perhaps it should be, which is Tarkovsky's personal interest in German mysticism, in Meister Eckhart, and that entire world, you know, and Meister Eckhart has this famous saying, you know, hearing is the language of the soul. And you get that with the soundscape of the film itself. You also have focusing on ears throughout the film, if you've noticed that, like the dead body, they zoomed in on their ear. When Kelvin first sees the dead body, and then later they zoom in on Kelvin's ear really, really closely as he's sort of giving his, like, one of his final monologues or something, which I found to be very interesting. And of course, in medieval mysticism, I'm going a little off the rails here, but stay with me. In medieval mysticism, the sun, soul, S-O-L, represented the soul, S-O-U-L. And so I think fundamentally what we're seeing in this film is, even though we're ostensibly going outward into the cosmos, Tarkovsky is taking us inward into the self, Solaris, right? It's not a, and we'll get to this as well, a science fiction classic film about going out and, you know, AI and artificial intelligence and human civilization extrapolated onto the cosmos. But it's really by going outward, we're going inward. And that's the journey that Tarkovsky is taking us on. So understanding this film as a journey into inner space and not outer space, I think, is also really fundamental to sort of grappling with its main themes and what it's trying to convey.
But there's a lot of those things that I think are extremely important. Ear was something that I found very haunting and almost unsettling. And I think one of the things I wanted to say about it, and part of this, maybe I didn't ask it, is it's considered like a science fiction drama. I mean, I hate looking at Wikipedia and saying, like, what is this film categorized as? Because it's very subjective. But this movie is almost kind of like a horror movie, but not in the same sense you think of a gory horror movie. It's this horror where you're forced to look inward. You're forced to look at something it makes you very uncomfortable. That's those silences in this movie. There's at least four or five times in this movie where it fades to black for more than a few seconds. That's usually considered like the kiss of death in a movie. You can't fade to black in the middle of the movie three, four times. And so it just makes me feel uncomfortable throughout. And I think that enables you to look at yourself as you're watching it and feel this haunting humanity.
Yeah. Overarchingly, this film is less about science fiction and more about humanity. You know, the love of humanity, the love that drives our need for change in societies and within ourselves. It's very interesting that I feel like there's a lot of practical effects in this film. It does rely, like, really a lot on sound and mirror reflections, images, you know, very simple imagery. Like the beginning of the film, like from the start, you know, it almost starts as if it's like in the middle of a story, you know, and you're in this like kind of countryside, you're trying to like kind of figure out who's who. And then the film of the, I guess he's a cosmonaut, or, you know, the guy that, what's his name? Not Chris. Chris is the main character, Burton. But the other guy, Burton. The younger version of him, you don't really recognize him as a younger version or even just as him telling this story. And so you're kind of almost disoriented just from the beginning of like trying to figure out is this another planet? Is this the planet Earth? That was like some couple of things that I was wondering in the beginning. But overarchingly, like, I feel like it is horror in a way that it is, you know, making you look more inward into your humanity. It is important to note that Tarkovsky, like, to note about him and his own personal life, he is a Russian Orthodox, very religious man. So kind of almost like his response to science is comes from like almost, I guess, like a spiritual perspective, but not overarchingly religious, I guess. But yeah, so I also did want to mention too, like how low of a budget this film had. I had read that it was only 1 million rubles, which is equivalent to like $900,000 today, I think, something like that. Whereas like Kubrick's, you know, 2021 was $10.5 million movie budget. But then at the same time, it's kind of unfair to compare the two films, like 2021 and Solaris is just completely dynamically different films. And I think that we kind of get caught up as Westerners. We get caught up in looking at like the Western imperialist perspective of our media or art and kind of compare it to Soviet, whether it's like a response to us or if we're a response to them. And it's not always the case. So I don't know. I don't know what you guys think about like that aspect, how the notion that this movie is considered by some critics as being a response to Kubrick's film.
Yeah, Evan, do you have thoughts on that? Because I have thoughts on other things that Amanda said, but...
Yeah, well, I want to read one quote from Tarkovsky that, I think is a very good, valid point that it doesn't maybe do us a service to be continuously comparing them or saying this is a response to that. I do think that this quote might give a little bit of a framing of how Tarkovsky saw film and why he made his movies the way he did. And maybe it's not so much a response, but just this is how I make how I view cinema as my art and how it might be different from a Western piece. So I'll just read this quote and then I'll let you, if you either want to respond to this or any other pieces. But he says, for example, if one shoots a scene of passengers boarding a trolley, which let's say we'd never seen or known anything about, then we'd get something like Kubrick's moon landing scene. On the other hand, if we were to shoot the moon landing like a common trolley stop in a modern film, then everything would be as it should. That means to create psychologically, not an exotic, but a real everyday environment that would be conveyed to the viewer through the perception of the film's characters. That's why a detailed examination of the technological processes of the future transforms the emotional foundation of a film as a work of art into a lifeless schema with only pretensions to the truth. And I think a lot of the things you both said and kind of how you felt about this movie and as we go through is that there isn't a focus on the supernatural or going out in space, moonwalking, even any of the items that are on the space station they go to surrounding Solaris planet. None of the technology matters to this movie. What matters is all of the expressions that we have while being engaged in space, being alone, coming to terms with our own mortality, our past, what's in the future, all of these things. So I think that Tarkovsky really built a movie that transcends the just kind of the things that don't really matter in movies that I think is often focused on in America. I'll leave that there.
That's important. Yeah. And I think Tarkovsky also called 2001 cold and sterile. And if you watch that film, it absolutely is. The humans are one dimensional. They don't have emotion. They don't have, any sort of, they're almost like automatons or, just like sort of robotic in the way that they're doing things. And of course, how the AI in 2001 represents that robotic, artificialized intelligence back to them. And this film is much more human. It's going into the human condition in a way that, Kubrick was very intellectual. And Amanda said something about Tarkovsky having faith and his work being infused with a spiritualism of one sort or another. And I think that is one of the main differences between Kubrick and Tarkovsky is, Kubrick has these intellectual ideas he's going to then use the medium of film to express. And I think Tarkovsky's more, he has these human emotions, right? In a sense. He's also intellectual, of course, but he has these human emotions he's going to use the visual art form of film to convey. And that makes for different experiences in the film. But that trolley quote you read from Tarkovsky is funny because – we're talking about whether or not this is sci-fi or horror, and I kind of see this as anti-sci-fi, right? It plays with some of the tropes. It has the scaffolding of a science fiction film, right? Spaceships, contact with an alien, intelligence set in the near future, etc. But it sort of just takes that scaffolding and doesn't build what we would commonly assume to be science fiction tropes onto it. It uses that scaffolding as an inward pointer to go inward to the human condition, the existential situation, as both of you are sort of alluding to in your different ways. So I think of it as anti-sci-fi or a too cute by half idea I came up with on the right over here is sci-fi, but spelled P-S-Y-fi, right? Psychological fiction. Because although it uses the sci-fi scaffolding, it's really about the psychological things that Tarkovsky is trying to express in the human condition itself. But outside of trying to label it, it sort of eludes categorization, has elements of Lovecraftian horror. The ocean is a sort of, ephemeral, intangible being? Is it sentient? You know, is it just a mirror? Maybe we can get into that in a little bit. Certainly elements of existential dread. But, you know, it's a psychological and philosophical exploration of the human mind and subjectivity in modernity. And it made me think of this quote. I don't remember where this quote is from, have no clue who said it. But there's this famous quote that it made me think of. It says, "Yes, I believe in ghosts, but we create them. We haunt ourselves." And in a sense, you know, that's what Kelvin is doing. That's what the ocean brings out in you, whether the ocean represents the subconscious, pulling the subconscious to the conscious. You know, it is a sort of using the psychological material already inside of Kelvin to haunt him with this apparition of his dead wife, and to watch her die again and again, which, you know, is a process that occurs throughout the film. So those are my thoughts on the genre, but I just wanted to kind of make clear what I think the primary themes of this film are, and get your guys' thoughts on it as well. And I think both of you have touched on these, but to make them explicit, there's one element where it's obviously talking about grief, memory, identity, loss, right? These human emotions, the human condition. So that's one main theme. The second one is that, yeah, I think Amanda said this sort of overarching critique of materialism, scientism, and rationalism. And yes, he's in the Soviet Union. He's sort of poking fun at the Soviet bureaucracy. Soviet society was very materialistic, right? I mean, Marxism is materialistic. There is atheism being promoted and displacing religious faith. And all of that is interesting, and it's certainly progress in a way. But by over and capitalist societies are not immune from this either. During the Cold War, you know, capitalist societies, and even to this day, just as materialistic in maybe a slightly different way, but still obsessed with scientism, with rationalism, and with material comfort and materialism writ large. So that's not a critique of either side of the Cold War. It's a critique of the Cold War and the sort of the ideology of both, which are in one way progressive, but in another way are held back by our inner immaturity as humans, right? So that's the second one. And then the third one is just this exploration of the human condition and the psyche, and this idea of Solaris as bringing out the subconscious and stuff like that. So yeah, I don't know. I love the film. It covers really, really deep topics and does it in a completely unique way that only Tarkovsky could really do.
But just to give everyone a very brief sketch of this movie, because it's very complex, but the plot itself is not very complex, which I think does the movie as assert not the opposite of a disservice. It's beneficial to have it be very much. There's really only two locations that this really movie takes place in. We talked about the opening. It's kind of a house in the countryside where Chris Kelvin, who's sort of the main protagonist in this movie, lives. He's living with his father. He gets visited by, this former cosmonaut, that had previously explored Solaris. We don't really have a sense of how long this has been, but it's clearly been decades, because in the film they watch together on this sort of fancy TV. Again, they have technology in this movie, but it's never a feature of explaining it. So we have this guy Burton, who is a pilot, telling his experience. And this is right before Chris Kelvin is going to go to the station, where there's three other scientists, and he's going to bring his own expertise, to understand this ocean or this sentient being. They don't really know what it is that sort of exists on this planet of Solaris. They haven't been able to kind of ascertain what it is. And so really, from the opening scene of about 30, 40 minutes of the movie taking place on Earth, we get you mentioned Brett earlier, like a 6-minute scene of driving in a car that's like an auto driving car, it's very weird. I don't know what the decision for that was to do it, but it's there. It's Tarkovsky. He decided to do it. And then what's, I think, quite marvelous is that the journey for him to go to space is about 30 seconds to a minute of the movie. Yeah. But this journey in this car to go to town was like 6 minutes. And so he finally arrives at the space station, and it's just like he's just arriving at any old place. It's not considered, there's nothing fantastical about his arrival. He just goes in, he's, you know, exploring, wants to see the other scientists. And we really only have two other scientists that are on the planet or on the station above. And the two of them are, Dr. Sartorius, and we have Dr. Snout. And we learned that the third doctor very early on had committed suicide and is dead, who had been a friend of Kelvin back on Earth and previously. And then the only other individual that kind of makes any presence, which you also alluded to, Brett, is Hari, which is sort of a recreation, but is very real to everyone who is there. Hari, which is Chris Kelvin's wife, who had also had committed suicide many years before on Earth. So the rest of the entire film takes place within this space station. We really just have the four characters, the two doctors, Chris Kelvin, and then Hari as the fourth person. And so the entire plot of the entire rest of the movie takes place in that small set of the station. And I think the build up to them getting there is it's somewhat slow, but it almost just kind of just drops you in, and you as the viewer are almost forced to understand what is happening and what is going to happen in the same way that Chris Kelvin is sort of understanding himself. And I really appreciate that as the viewer, having almost no information, despite the fact that they've kind of shared some inkling. And so I don't know how you both saw I think maybe we've already talked about them on Earth. I think maybe now it's worth talking about the crux of this movie and the bulk of it being on the station and how you felt about just the arrival on the station, anything related to just kind of they just kind of drop you off. And then you're in for the ride the same way that the Kelvin is. So
Mando, you want to start?
So I think that it's pretty telling of like, okay, so, you know, it does rely a lot on like practical effects, which I think is due to its small budget, which I appreciate. I think the films I enjoy the most are, you know, they get the point across without going too into depth of things. So when I was watching it, like the scene when they're going through the tunnels and just the frenzy and the noise, so unnerving. But I was like, are they going into space now? Is this how they get into space? Like, it would make sense. But yeah, and it's just like a blink of the eye and they're in space. What I was going to say about it, a few things is like also more practical effects while they're in space. I did want to note how cool Chris was just like casually walking in with his leather jacket the whole time. Like, that guy is so cool.
Yeah.
And I think... I'm kind of jumping around a little bit because I always think of like the historical context of like how and why films are made. It's not lost on me that like all of the names of the characters are like more Western names, you know, like maybe Dr. Snout was like the least, and it wasn't a predominantly Russian cast, which is kind of, you know, unless in it being a Russian director, kind of not really done very often. I mean, there's Russia's a big country, you know, big part of the Soviet Union. But yeah, that's kind of what I go into it. And I'm thinking about the humanity aspect of the film, that like 1976, that was era of like, you know, 3 years, the Soviets were about to go into Afghanistan. We have Brezhnev, who like divested in social programs. So there was a lot of anti-humanism going on and more into, you know, the military and stuff like that, kind of jumping around a little bit. I apologize, but it is an era of severe ramping of neoliberalism, which I think is a very anti-human aspect of a society. But yeah, like going into space, I don't really have much else to say. What do you got, Brett?
Yeah, no, I like that. I like that materialist analysis of the background society from which this film emerges, right? That's a very Marxist way of trying to wrestle with the film, is taking into consideration, yeah, the background society from which a film emerges, right? Because we understand ideology, we understand how it works, we understand art and its relation to society more broadly. So yeah, really interesting stuff. You know, you mentioned the leather jacket and it's hilarious. Underneath that, he has a mesh sort of tank top. So it's like he's literally getting off an interstellar space trip in like a mesh shirt with a leather jacket, and he has like a bag like he's just getting off the train, which speaks you know, to his earlier quote about the trolley situation. Is very funny. But if you notice, so the Japan highway thing, right, the in my opinion, the Japan's highway and the focusing on it is like its loudness sort of exemplifies how modern society is an escape from hearing, and it gets louder. Like as that 5 minute, 6 minute scene sort of culminates, it's like almost like I had to take my headphones out and set, you know, it's like it was getting too loud. And I think he's doing that on purpose. Yeah. Because, you know, we're, it's a boisterous eruption of sound and color, keeping us eternally distracted and preventing us the silence necessary for us to really hear, for us to really go inward. And it speaks to this interesting concept that comes from a book, a rather famous book by Ernest Becker called Denial of Death, came out many decades ago. But one of the basic premises of that book is humans create culture as a sort of way to sublimate our deep fear of death. Being the only self-conscious creatures on Earth that know we're going to die, that puts us in an incredibly unique and scary and precarious existential situation. And cultural production and the invention of culture, from politics to economics to art, history, all of it, is the way that humans sort of wrestle with their own mortality. And so if we take that idea seriously, then yeah, the highway, and we were looking at the buildings and the signs and all the cars, this is modern society, but something's lacking. There's something that isn't quite developed within the human psyche quite yet. So there's this outward development, but there is not a proportional inward development. And so what happens is Japan's scene is very long. You're driving through the streets, very loud. The trip to Solaris, if we take it seriously, that it's a trip inward. Well, you're right here. There's nowhere to go. So of course it's a blink of an eye. It's the blink of looking inward instead of looking outward, right? And I think that is driven home in the fact that during that quick scene, that trip to Solaris is focused on Kelvin's eyes, the doorways to the soul. It zooms really close in on his eyes. The trip is inward. And I think that's what Tarkovsky is trying to say with that quick trip and with the focus on the eyes. And of course, Kelvin is a psychologist. So he's a psychologist going to help these other scientists deal with their psychological issues of being so close to Solaris. And the whole film is a psychological exploration. The psychologist needs a psychologist, right? Yeah. I found that very, very funny and interesting. And then with the apparitions of the people, they say that they're not composed of atoms, like normal carbon-based life forms, but they're composed of neutrinos, which are notoriously volatile. But the force field, they say the force field around Solaris allows those neutrino entities to stabilize. So they're not merely apparitions. Like they're not merely ghostly, intangible, you know, ephemera. But there's something materially there. Everybody sees the same things. So, you know, it's drawing on their subconscious. It's pulling something out of all of them. But all of them are able to see the things as material realities, tangible people, because of this sort of, yeah, the stabilized neutrino concept, which I don't know much about the physics of that, if that's even reasonable, but I find it interesting to say the least. So yeah, all of that stuff is very interesting, and I could go a million different directions, but those are some of my thoughts on what you guys both said.
But not just his leather coat and his shirt, his pants are also like very, they're like, I don't know how to describe them, but they have like leather straps on them. Like this is, I guess, how they send you into space. Like you don't even, like only once in the entire movie is there ever like a space suit, like yeah, anything that's donned. That's, and I like kind of this disconnection from the science. And I think maybe that's a good segue. It doesn't maybe come into play with all of the different other themes of humanity and all these things. But one that maybe comes first and foremost is, you mentioned, Amanda, that Tarkovsky is a religious person, and then you have Kelvin coming to space as a psychologist to talk to the other people there. I think is an astrophysicist, and I'm blanking on what the third one is. And so there is this immediate contradiction of someone who's there to look inward at someone's mind, as Kelvin might be, versus the people there who are there for physical, tangible evidence of science. So there's already this contradiction, I think, between science and, you know, psychology or the mind, the body, how one is actually experiencing it. I don't think that the scientists that are there, Snout and the other one, really are able to articulate any of this feeling that's happening. And I don't even know that Kelvin is able to really articulate how he's feeling until maybe at the very end of the movie we get a little bit of understanding, which we'll get to. So I don't know what you thought about how that they use science. I mean, one of the only scientific mentions in the entire movie really is he forces Kelvin is forced to take the blood of Hari, his wife, and he draws the blood to kind of bring him down and back to reality, to understanding, like to be grounded. And he sees that the blood exists, it can be replicated. And I don't know, maybe I'm making sense, but how you perceive the science of this in the, and I guess this goes back to your comment, Brett, of you call this sci-fi. So like that really is more to the point. Like it's kind of like, it's a contradiction of science fiction versus this psychology.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Let's see where I should go with this. let's just think of technology at the time and the Soviet mindset. So, you know, the Soviets are, and just like the Americas, in the hothouse of the Cold War, but also because of their own independent need to develop their economies, technology, et cetera, are obsessed with science. The space race, right? All of these different things. So we have to remember too, zooming out, that socialism in the Soviet Union took a backward, semi-feudal society, and in a few decades, unprecedented in human history as far as developmental time spans go, took a backward semi-feudal society and in a few decades turned it into a world superpower competing with the US in the space race. I mean, we sometimes don't fully understand just how amazing that is. And in the process, it's producing amazing science and technology, and a society in that context has to be hyper-focused on technology and its development and the techno-optimism, as naive as it sometimes is, that can come with it. And I'm sure all of you are familiar with going back and reading old Soviet citizens' predictions of the future. They were utopian. They saw themselves as part of, you know, this progress of humanity, that socialism is the next step in human development, and the technological development that was coming under the context of socialism in the Soviet Union was going to produce this amazing utopian sort of world in the future, you know, when socialism finally wins out. And there's like an old capsule online. You can go back and just like read a bunch of regular Soviet citizens talking about, you know, what do you think is going to happen by the year 2020 or 2000? And, you know, of course, the history went a different way. The Soviet Union collapsed for a bunch of reasons, over bureaucratization, revisionism, etc. But you know, that they were in that mindset. And so technology is playing there, but it's always in the background for Tarkovsky. Tarkovsky pushes it back to bring the psyche to the foreground. So those are some of my opening thoughts about technology. I'm not exactly sure where to go next with it, but I'd love to hear Amanda or your thoughts on it.
Yeah. I mean, the revolutionary optimism,
Yes. That's
what you speak of, is that revolutionary optimism. In my early 30s, I went to Texas and I went to the Johnson Space Center. I think that's in Houston. I'm not sure. And they had, you know, these kind of replicated historical moments. So like there's that moment, and I'm not sure. I don't remember what year it was. I feel like it was somewhere like the 50s, 60s. I should have just looked this up so I could sound smart. But anyway, there's like that moment where like the US astronaut and the Soviet cosmonaut, they like meet up, like they kind of like shook hands in space. It's kind of a historical moment that they actually had to recreate for a picture opportunity. So there was, yeah, like the great race to space was, I felt like it was such a healthy competition. Like the only like imperialist US versus Soviet, the superpower competition, you know, was to get to space. And so I think about that a lot when I'm thinking about like the history of like the Cold War and the race to space. I think about like that moment of like almost, it was like a hopeful time. I feel like a lot of like post 1952 Soviet Union was about kind of like, hey, rest of the world, like we're Soviets, you know, but like we're just like you. Mm-hmm. We like art, we like, you know, we like these things, and just kind of like in a way kind of pandering to the West for acceptance, because, you know, Cold War, that's not fun for anybody, especially the Soviets, who were the center for, you know, the focal point of that. Another thing, gosh, I had so many, many different thoughts about this, but overall, overarchingly, was that revolutionary optimism. And also, mind you, during this time with Brezhnev and the divestment in social programs and the investment allocation to more militarization of the Soviet Union, we also have like a huge shift in the economy. So at the same time, there was, you know, the overarching, like, yes, the future is socialism. But at the same time, over the years, I feel like it's so hard not to feel this way post 1952. And we know what happened in 1952. The Soviet Union kind of starts to push back that end goal of socialism for all, you know, like that plan, more and more. And with Khrushchev, you know, what he did, kind of ramping up like the beginning of the end in a way. There was this revolution optimism, but at the same time, as you could see in a lot of the cinema of that era, was looking back, but also looking forward. And I feel like some people held on to that idea of that socialist future and that revolutionary optimism. And I still think that a lot of those people still exist. You know, that if you go and you talk to people in the Soviet Union today, they wish that it was still the Soviet Union. But there were some people that also kind of, I don't know if it was mostly just like Western influence or neoliberalism, but just kind of getting fed up with like how long the project was going to take. You know, you kind of lose that ideology when you don't yield the results. Because mind you, the Soviet Union is the very first in all of human history to do this sort of project. So in it has successes and failures. It was essentially still an experiment, overarchingly. So,
yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting point. And I loved your point about the humanist or the humanizing aspect of art as like, you know, bridging this gap between the West and the East, Russia and the US, the Soviet Union and the American bloc. Like, we're human too, you know, because in the US, it's this hot, they're atheists, they're communists. These are dehumanizing terms. We are defined by being the opposite of what they are. And that is an inherently dehumanizing process. And the art from both ways coming over is one of the ways that we reconnect with our own humanity. And there's a sense in which, and perhaps Tarkovsky is thinking of this when he's making a film like this, that the human element was lost sight of in perhaps both cases. You know, the collapse of the Soviet Union and even to the U.S. to this very day is anti-human to the core. There is no sense that the American project is geared toward human happiness or the well-being of its citizens or advancement for human civilization. It's raw, naked power and greed and extraction and domination. And without that human element, without realizing what we're in the business of building civilization for, right? We dehumanize ourselves. We dehumanize our world. And we live in this, you know, in the future, like this techno dystopian reality where the technological outward progress of human culture has, as I've said earlier, and I'll probably say it again, outpaced the internal development such that we're alienated by our own creations. We live in a hyper technological world of our own creation that feels more alien and more distant than ever before. And that gap is worth thinking about and exploring. And if the Soviet Union collapsed, I don't consider it the U.S. beat the Soviet Union. I think they're both collapsing. Just the U.S. is just lagging behind, right? Give the U.S. another 30 years and it too will collapse because some of the same rot is at play here. And I think we're living in the 2020s through some sort, I don't know where it's going to end, but some sort of collapse, if not of the entire American project, then of its empire. Certainly we're at the end of neoliberalism. What comes next? Who the hell knows? But I don't have this triumphalist view. I'm a Marxist, so that probably speaks to why. But I don't have this triumphalist view that the U.S. beat the Soviet Union. I think the Soviet Union was ultimately defeated from inside pressure, inside contradictions, revisionism, etc., more than anything else. And I think the U.S. is being eaten away in the exact same way. So the U.S. through the 90s like sat on its laurels and was on its high horse and like, hey, we won. And then 9/11 happened. And then the war on terror. And then, you know, the financial crisis. And then Trump and the pandemic. And everything has been a downhill slide since then. So maybe for 10 years, the U.S. got to celebrate its quote unquote victory. But it's a hollow victory because the U.S. is collapsing as well. So, yeah, I really like those points and the human element being lost sight of. And Tarkovsky really interested in bringing that human element fully back in and telling us you're not mature enough to do these things you want to. You want to go out and contact other life forms? Where's the intelligent life on Earth? Look at the genocide in Gaza. Look how we treat each other. Look at the homeless people right now all across America, the richest country to ever exist in human history. And you're telling me you want to live forever and download your consciousness and go out and meet the aliens and take your place among the stars. Get real. Grow up. And I think that's what Tarkovsky's telling us in so many words here.
Yeah, these are all excellent pieces. And I think to maybe take that last point, Brett, to kind of the next, I don't want to call it the next phase of the movie, but the next sort of, Kelvin is now kind of starting to experience, you mentioned the apparition of his, now his dead wife, coming back and sort of, I almost said haunting, but I almost do feel like it is a little bit of a haunting nature because they are all, no one could explain to him what he would experience. And I think it speaks to just the idea of how we experience loss and grief. No one can tell you how you are going to experience grief or how you experience or will experience love or loss or sacrifice. So I think that it speaks to these human emotions that no one could tell him, Chris Kelvin, the protagonist, how he would experience seeing his dead wife and how reliving her dying. I think she dies several times in different ways throughout the movie, but comes back and they leave these weird. I love some of the little notes of kind of getting more technical is like her little scarf blanket on the side of the chair. And then she comes back and there's a second one on the side of the chair. And then it gets stuffed into a cargo hold and we see it again. So there's these memories and these markers that remember your human experience. So I wonder as we maybe get into a slightly more philosophical piece of this is we have this ocean of Solaris that we don't really understand. No one is understanding what it's doing. Is it taking these memories and turning them into reality so you can relive them? Is it trying itself to understand the human experience for itself? Because his wife, Hari, learns things as she's alive and around humans more. Just like how children, as we grow up, we learn about the human experience and how to do things by being with other people, how to, you know, she learns how to sleep. She learns how to eat. She has that scene later in the movie where she doesn't know how to drink water. But she's learning to love. I know I'm saying a lot of different things here, but I guess the question is, how do you maybe understand or how you felt you understood what the ocean of Solaris was trying to do, and maybe what does that tell us about our own experience of how we should be more inward, as you've been saying a lot, Brett, is how do we look inward in ourselves in a way that none of these scientists and most people are unable to do because of just the external forces of having to live and survive and the capitalist excess and all of these things, the noise that's around us. So
yeah, sure. I'll take a first stab at this. And it kind of goes into this question you put on the outline. Of course, we're jumping around, but the use of mirrors, right? Mm-hmm. So we have this whole idea of this being a journey into our inner world, Solaris, the soul going inward. And Snout has this this quote that stood out to me, and I'll read it and see what we can make of it. Snout says in the film, quote, "Science? Nonsense. In this situation, mediocrity and genius are equally useless. I must tell you that we really have no desire to conquer any cosmos. We want to extend the Earth up to its borders. We don't know what to do with other worlds. We don't need other worlds. We need a mirror. We struggle to make contact, but we'll never achieve it. We are in a ridiculous predicament of man pursuing a goal that he fears and that he really does not need. Man needs man." And that's how the quote ends. And what I think is this is, you know, the mirror motif is like made explicit in actual mirrors, looking at your reflection, looking inward over and over again, catching eye contact with yourself. But then I think also art in this film, and because art is what Harry looks into and becomes human. And they have that scene in the library where they start levitating because there's like 30 seconds of weightlessness. And that is sort of, you know, Tarkovsky's visual attempt to show us the transcendence of love and that Hari is becoming human through her engagement first with art and then her feeling of love, which I think is sort of beautiful. But if we take the even art to be some sort of a mirror, then perhaps Solaris isn't a separate intelligent entity. Maybe it is a mirror of sorts. And what you see when you look into that mirror is the stuff behind your conscious mind. It's your subconscious. It's your grief. It's these memories that you're repressing. It's your fears, your desires. And that's what it brings out. So a normal mirror, you see the external surface of yourself. You see your face, you know, you see your body, your clothes. but this is a mirror that shows you the inside. And so I don't actually think that Solaris, and, you know, this is just pure speculation, everybody has a different interpretation, but I don't see Solaris as an actually sentient being or a separate intelligence. I see it as the ultimate mirror. And that's why it's so disturbing, right? That's why it's haunting, and that's why it's horrific, because it is it's an inside mirror. And that's what, ultimately, I think that's what it represents.
Yeah. And I'll just add one quote that I think also talks about the mirrors. This is when, like you said, there's actual physical mirrors in the movie. And then there's also just almost every scene at some point, there's some glass or reflection of something in there. And you never kind of get the same reflection, except there's a scene where Hari and Kelvin are in the room. I think this is when she returns the second time. They're looking in the mirror together and she says, "I don't know myself at all. When I close my eyes, I can't recall my face. Do you know yourself like all humans?" And I mean, that is, it's really haunting. Like that is just, do we know ourselves? And I think that's speak to your point, Brett, of we need to look beyond just the eyes that we see in the mirror to like get a glimpse of our souls. And I think that's a good way to look at it, that Solaris isn't necessarily sentient. It's almost like it's doing the job of it being sentient. Like if you believe that it is, it'll force you to look inward in some way, you know, like, cause they constantly have the shots of it, like the melding around and you know, like you're kind of mesmerized by it. And it's going to cause you to look inward. But in the reality, they're all doing it themselves. They're the ones doing the work, quote unquote. I don't know. That speaks like a more of like psychological kind of thing. All right, but you should go ahead, Amanda.
Yeah, I mean, the reflection of, you know, looking inside of yourself as individuals. But I think also Tarkovsky is saying to his society, his people, to also look at yourself and you know, and I guess where we are, what we're doing. That's probably why there was, you know, it was a little iffy being released in the Soviet Union. I think they held off on releasing it for a few years. Because of that, and that's also ultimately what pushed him to immigrate, I think, to Italy, I think is where he went, and he filmed like his last three films there. But overall, oh, another scene. Okay. I have to talk about this scene before I forget. So there's a scene where he's sitting in a chair, like in that like kind of conference room with, I think the older doctors, that Dr. Snout, and he basically is asking the question, like, what is the meaning of life in a way? I don't know if that's the exact words that he does, but it's a very pensive and reflective moment. And it honestly reminds me of another movie in a scene, overarchingly what the theme of the movie is, Holy Mountain by Alejandro Jodorowsky. And it's like, you know, the exploration of what is the meaning of life. But it's a very small part of the whole story. But I think that that is an important question in the film and like the development of his character and understanding Solaris and what he's even doing there and what he's experiencing the death of his wife over and over again. And I really, really liked that scene in particular. It really stuck out to me quite a bit, or he's just like, what's the meaning of life?
He says that exact line. He says the meaning of life. And he says, that's a banal question. And he says, when man is happy, you shouldn't have to be, these questions should be asked at the end of one's life. We don't know when that life will end. Why are we in such a hurry? You know, we shouldn't ask these cursed questions. Things should be a mystery. So really it is a very much, I don't remember which one of you mentioned earlier of this being kind of a sense of, did you, Brett, who said earlier, maybe it was with, I lost that part, but yeah, go ahead.
No, yeah, that quote, he says, yeah, you were both saying like only unhappy people ask such questions. You know, this obsession with like, what does stuff mean and all of that. And I know in like periods of depression or existential crisis that I've experienced in my life, those questions are all you think about. But when you're actually engaged in life, when you're actually, you know, losing yourself in the world by going out and being in the world, those questions aren't appearing to you. You know, when you're in the middle of really good sex or you're eating great food or you're with your friends laughing around, you're not tormenting yourself about what's the purpose of my life. And so that I think speaks to this inherent discontent in the human condition that Tarkovsky's exploring. But this, I kind of want to, if you give me a second to kind of flesh out this idea of this imbalance, right, between in humanity, between its outward development and its inward development, which I think is crucial to this film. It really makes me think of, you know, Elon wanting to go to Mars, or these Silicon Valley freaks trying to live forever, right? The alienated pursuit of external knowledge and life expansion without the wisdom, the maturity, and really the worthiness of achieving those things, right? We do not understand ourselves, yet we seek to be gods. And the mirrors, as we said many times, are begging us to look inside, to reflect, instead of desperately flailing outward in some abstract search for truth out there. So being alienated from ourselves and from nature, we sort of distract ourselves with this search for other life forms and new planets to colonize. But in those desperate searches, it's revealed the need to know more about ourselves and to integrate our advanced societies back into harmony with nature. And I think that's, you know, the film opens with this beautiful visual exploration of nature begging us to come back. You don't need to go out and, you know, colonize new planets, terraform Mars. Come back to right here, because there is beauty and there's harmony and there's lessons to be learned from nature itself. The less we know about ourselves, right, the more fervent we are in our search for other life forms, right? The search itself becomes a dark mirror, a mirror we sort of look past instead of into. The less we take care of our own planet, our own beautiful Garden of Eden, right, the more fervent we are in our search for another planet to colonize. The search itself is a dark mirror. If we can terraform Mars, you know, can't we act as good stewards to the Earth? What does it say about a species who, while actively destroying its own world, is obsessed with the idea of finding another? And now, would we be worthy of going to another planet having destroyed our own? You know, are we just going to destroy this one? What's the point? It really reminds me of like the teenager, you know, like the 16-year-old who can't keep their own room clean or remember to brush their teeth, pining for the moment that they can move out and get into their own place. I have a niece who's kind of going through this growing pain where she's incredibly like sort of naive about financial realities and how difficult it is to maintain rent and to buy a car and a car payment. But she really wants that freedom. And of course, she deserves it and she will get it. But it's that asymmetry and that imbalance between, you know, her internal development and what the external world is really gonna be like. And I feel like if we can look at human progress as like a single lifespan, we're in our teenage years. We're growing into ourselves. You know, we're doing exciting things. We're going out in the world and building things like a teenager would, but we lack the maturity and the internal development to have the wisdom and the compassion, to really take those things, to a further extent. So we need to continue to develop our internal lives. Like the angsty teenager needs to continue to develop internally to be able to meet the outside world as a mature adult. And I think humanity is in our adolescent stage, very outward focused, very egoic. But we need to be humbled, you know? So those are kind of my thoughts on that. And I really like this idea that I always talk about of like going back to the Elon Musks and the Silicon Valley guys who want to live forever, but they can't even live in the moment. The guy who wants to take all the pills and do blood transfusions to stay forever young is now living in a present moment, obsessed with the next moment. So why do you deserve eternal life or radically expanded life when you can't? You can't sit down and look inward. You can't actually appreciate the present moment. You're in this frantic search to trying to prevent this thing in the future, death, that's coming, to the extent that you don't even know anything about life. And that the more desperate you are to live forever, the less worthy you are of it, because you wouldn't know what to do with eternal life if you got it, you know? And so I think that interesting psychological, pathological, thing that we can see in figures like that is also present, I think, within humanity as a whole.
People tend not to ask, you know, they never ask, like, should we do these things, right? They don't ask the questions of what's the repercussions of trying to live forever. And I think this also plays really well into one of the later scenes. I think one of the best scenes maybe in the whole movie. There's lots of fantastic scenes, but it's right before the part where Hari and they sort of float in that moment. They're all kind of talking together, and it's a scene about talking about love. And I think they say, you know, until today, love was simply unattainable to mankind, to Earth. There are so few of us, a few billion of us all together. We're just a handful. Maybe we're here in order to experience people. And it kind of gets cut off because he's sick and they need to attend to him. But it's the sense of, if we loved each other or we understood ways to improve the things we already have, instead of thinking about, oh, let's go to Mars and figure out how we can commit, you know, space imperialism, you know, the next phase of whatever it is we're doing, exploration. Because, of course, these guys aren't going to just go there and build the stuff themselves. They need someone to do it for them. So, you know, this contradiction, I think you mentioned too, Amanda, of like what's happening in the Soviet Union at this moment in history is how can they, all these people within this, you know, you mentioned there's billions of people. There's many people can do so many great things, but it doesn't always have to be outwardly. You can benefit society simply by working on your own self and being with other people and experiencing all these things. And I think that the quote unquote Osher, the sentient being within, you know, Solaris, is creating some way for these people to have this internal connection. And it's very hard for them. I mean, I think that's what makes all of them start to go insane, is that they've never had to experience something like this. And so I think even just watching it, you feel this uncomfortable. I did. I felt uncomfortable thinking about these questions of morality. I mean, it is very, it's hard to grasp. It's just hard to, maybe that's why none of them can explain what's happening, because they don't know. They can't scientifically explain love and emotion, which is what Hari is trying to learn. I mean, the idea of learning love is just such a foreign concept for anyone. Like, I mean, how many thousands of books have been written by psychologists and philosophers about all of these things? And no one has an answer. You can go to Solaris and you're not going to get an answer.
And it's the non-human who's most human, right? Hari comes out to be the most human character, the most vulnerable, the most connected, the most in tune with her own emotions, the most expressive of love. So it's funny that the smartest people in the world, right, are the most internally underdeveloped, and the non-human is more human than the humans. Again, speaking to this overarching theme. So yeah, very interesting.
I come back to the theme that this movie is, it's about love. I just like over again. There's this quote here in this film review that I got, that I found from like 1976, where he says, "With Hari's reappearance, however, the whole character of the film changes. The ocean now begins to be seen as the source, not of ghosts, but of love." And at this point, Chris begins his return back towards society. What his growing love for Hari will reveal to him is the validity of his father's humanistic and socially divergent viewpoint, for which Tchaikovsky has provided a complex cultural reference.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the father who we briefly see in the opening of the movie, and we see a glimpse of him at a film he watches from his childhood. And then we will have to discuss the very last scene in this movie, because I have to hear everyone's thoughts. It's one of those quote unquote non-Hollywood, you know, ambiguous endings that I love in film. I hate everything's wrapped up in a nice little bow and we're all going to go home. But I think that the other piece, aside from love, is also just love of his father and his mother. They show his mother in this little film, and he just doesn't. He has all these people in his lives who he should have had connection with. He realizes that maybe another thing, when Hari tells him that he loves him, he doesn't respond with saying that I love you. It's also this very difficult thing. And I think, as you said, Brett, the only non-human is the one who learns what love is. And I think that it's just so hard for humans to grasp these emotions. And I think that's what makes the movie so compelling to me, because it's so real. You look at a movie, as we go back to 2001, it's a movie about space and science and computers and AI and the creation of man. It's not really about human emotion in any way. This movie is about a human emotion that is just, I think it's everything we've been talking about comes back to it.
Yeah. 2001 is like an examination of humanity from the outside in, and this is an exploration of humanity from the inside out. And that's mm-hmm. the dialectical complement that Tarkovsky offers to Kubrick's 2001, I think. But, you know, another thing that, you know, Amanda's talking about love, and you were too as well, Evan. And you know, I always struggle with this, because when you start talking about love, you can't help but start to sound kind of cliche. And you know, on a very shallow level, like saying this movie is about love can make people be like, okay, enough's enough. You know, like, stop. This is silly. But love really is the most important thing. Like love, it's when you talk about it, it sounds like you're like a third grader trying to do poetry, but it really is the crucial thing. And our politics, as those of us on the socialist, communist, Marxist left, as much as our detractors see as evil, power hungry psychopaths, the truth is we love each other. We love humanity. We love Palestinians. I love the homeless man on the street. And I don't always feel that way because, you know, in your life, you get very self-focused. My job, my finances, this is what I want. I'm cold. I want to put on my coat and get warm. And I could really go for a beer right now. We are very self-obsessed. Of course we are. But those moments where love breaks through, and not the conditional love, not the love you have for somebody who does something for you. I love my partner. She loves me back. She's faithful to me. As long as she meets these criteria, our relationship can stick together. And as long as I offer her these things, she'll still love me, right? That's a very childish conception of love. But unconditional universal love, I think that really is, if humanity is going to evolve, I think that's the fulcrum around which humanity can possibly evolve. What is Jesus telling us? Whether or not you believe in Jesus, whether it's a story humans made up or a real being, what is Jesus saying other than to fully love one another as we love ourselves? That's an impossible task in modernity because we love ourselves. You know, I always say like people in societies, even secular societies, everybody worships something. And those societies that pretend not to worship anything like our modern society worships things harder than ever. And what do we worship in America? We worship the self. We worship money. We worship things. And that leaves us in a spiritual desert, where we are fundamentally alienated and unhappy, and we can't even fully understand why we're unhappy, but we're always unhappy. It's because we worship the wrong things, and we should worship. And if there's anything worthy of worship, it is this feeling of love. And I don't want to get too weird with it, but you know, I have a spiritual background, mostly coming out of Buddhism, intensive meditation, stuff like that over many years. And when I've had moments of what I would call spiritual experiences, they are preceded by long periods of deep spiritual existential suffering. And then at the very end of that period of suffering, it breaks open into a brief moment of universal love. And I remember the last time this happened to me, I was, you know, going through a really tough time mentally, existentially, spiritually, losing my father, a miscarriage that we had. It was really piling up and I was suffering deeply. And I remember driving through a Target parking lot. And all of that suffering sort of culminated. I was by myself in this moment where I just started weeping, and all the people with their little grocery carts going in and out of the store, I loved them like my own children. It only lasted for about 5 minutes, but I wept out of pure love for these complete strangers. And if you can just get a taste of what universal love feels like, you can understand how important, how deep, and how non-shallow and non-cliche it really is. And I think somebody like Tarkovsky has at least touched that. He knows that. And that, I think, is really, really deep if you can wrestle with it. And I think it is the path forward for humanity and is the fulcrum around which we can develop that inside part to match our outward development, ultimately.
Yeah. And I that indication of our love for humanity is what differentiates you from being on the right side of history, mm-hmm. I guess you would say, for a simple way of saying it. I also want to point out that a lot of people, especially in the Western society, are obsessed with comfort. Mm. And that's why, you know, I've heard, you know, what's going on in this newest season of Palestine occupation, the occupation of Palestine and the aggression, is that I've heard of people saying, we don't need this much information. We can't handle this much information. We shouldn't know this much. I can't even comprehend that. But that comes from one's obsession with comfort. Oh, I don't know. I'm neutral. I'm unbiased. I don't engage in politics. That is impossible to not engage in politics. Everything, every aspect of our existence is politics, whether you like it or not. But that is the driving force of what differentiates you from those that call themselves leftists, and those people that are actually on the correct path of history, is that overarchingly in those quiet moments when we think about history, we think about current state of affairs, we think about our neighbors, the homeless guy in the corner, you know, like that we feel that love. And I really do appreciate you being vulnerable in that, like talking about that in that. And I do feel that way towards people sometimes too, just in those quiet moments though, those very quiet moments. And, it's heartbreaking and it's reinvigorating at the same time that like, okay, I am on the right path that like, as much as I despise the occupation and wish nothing but those that uphold that viciousness towards humanity, I am overarchingly, I say that word over and over again, overwhelmingly, have love for the Palestinian people, for all colonized people that, you know, Sudan and, you know, Congo, all of those people, all colonized people, workers and oppressed people of the world unite.
Absolutely. And to your point, Amanda, you made a really good point about people wanting to look away. This is too much information. I can't look at it. What's underneath that urge to look away? Fear. Fear, because what really loving people does is it breaks your fucking heart. And to look at the suffering of other people and to feel that heartbreak is scary. It's overwhelming. You don't know what to do with it. And so you would rather just look away. And that's not even a conscious process on behalf of these people who want to look away. It's a subconscious one. But fear is the thing there, because to open your heart wide enough is to allow your heart to be fucking shattered. And you have to go through that to get to the other side. That heartbreak is a part of love. But that's too much for a lot of people, and they would much rather look away, and they'll justify it in a million different ways. But ultimately it's fear of that heartbreak and fear of opening up to the suffering of other human beings that keeps them wanting to keep their eyes in a different direction. Watch the new Netflix show. Look at your phone, go on social media and start scrolling, anything but to sit here in this moment and feel this fucking pain. And that's something that is in all of us, but we all have a duty to one another to try to overcome that. To overcome that fear, to face that heartbreak, to keep our hearts wide open, and to love other people deeply, because that really is our only hope.
And I think taking that slightly back into the movie is in two ways. One, it goes back to the highway scene of noise, where you can't bring that noise prevents you from having these realizations of love. And so you come to Solaris, where there's limited, you know, things that distractions. There's limited distractions there. And then the second thing, I think even on a more personal level in the movie, you're talking about more on a widely basis of loving a people, loving the people who are oppressed. But in some people's lives, in many people's lives, you're afraid to love even a singular other person. And just like in this movie, we have Kelvin unable to comprehend the love for his wife, who he now feels guilty for why she killed herself, is because he didn't love her enough. He didn't care about her, didn't put her ahead. As you were talking, Brett, there's these things that are maybe in between individual people. But I think Tarkovsky has to use the individual of Kelvin and Hari as these stand-ins for this larger world of love to create, in a cliche way, the world that we all can actually benefit from. We all can actually live together and all these things. And so I think those are all both great ways. And I think the last thing maybe of the movie we should talk about is the final scene. So the final scene of this movie is a bit confusing because you don't really understand exactly what's happening. You have a dream of Kelvin. You don't know whether it's a dream, a fantasy, a mixed memory where he sees his mother. And then we kind of go through and we then see where we believe that maybe he's now back on Earth. He's returned home. He's in the house outside that we started the movie at. He's outside in nature. He sees the same lake. He sees the same water. You're like, oh, it's a full circle. We're back to the beginning again. And then we go inside and he sees his father and there's water dripping, which is very strange. And it starts to slowly zoom out. I mean, one thing we didn't talk about in this movie that I just have to toss in, like the cinematography of just like the camera, the slow pan is used to just build the tension that is hard to comprehend. But we have in the last scene this slowly fading out and we see an island that appears to be located in the Solaris Ocean. And we also briefly learned that they shot gamma rays or X-rays at it, and they claimed that it was starting to build these little islands or these life forms within it. And so it leaves you in this very ambiguous note of the same horse runs by, is in the first scene. We maybe see a connection to his father, and then we see him on the ground, kind of, you know, beholden in grief and sadness and love to his father in the same similar camera shot that we see earlier to Hari, of just, it's just everything is culminating, and then it just, that's it. It goes to black, and that's it. And so I'm curious what you both make of the ending. And I looked online, and there's so many interpretations of how it could be foreseen, whether it's his memory, actually it's happening, it's both, you know, so there's no answer. There's no wrong answers here.
Sure. Yeah, I can start if that's okay.
Oh, go ahead.
Sure. Well, one, I just want to step back really quick and make one really quick point about you asked a question. We're not going to get to it, of course, but I just wanted to mention this, and it speaks to my overall arguments throughout this episode, which is the decrepit nature of the space station, right? On the inside of the space station, everything is overturned. Everything is like shitty. There's litter everywhere. And again, on the inside, it's a mess, right? On the outside, when you're zooming in on the space shuttle, it's glimmering. You can see it as like a space station type thing, beautiful, a monument to human creativity and ingenuity. And on the inside of that spaceship, it's a mess, because on the inside, we're a mess. And that's Tarkovsky driving that point home. As for your last scene, yeah, incredibly ambiguous, not even sure what to make of it. But I could not help but notice that when he falls to his knees and hugs his father around the waist, that is a visual representation of the prodigal son, right? The biblical story turned into many artistic paintings. If you Google right now, prodigal son painting, you'll see the son prone, holding his father around the waist as his father welcomes him back. And what is the story of the prodigal son? It is a story of which a father has inheritance. One son irresponsibly comes to him and says, "Can I have all my inheritance now, please?" And he's like, "Sure," gives him all the inheritance. The son goes off, lives a life of debauchery and hedonism, gambles all his money away, and then comes crawling back to his father and saying, "You know, I don't have anything left. Please take me in." I think the father finds him like in a, you know, disheveled state on the side of the road and brings him home. The other brother, who was much more responsible with his inheritance, you know, who actually invested his inheritance, took it at the right time, made something out of it, asks his father, "Why are you welcoming him back? He wasted all your money. He made a mockery of everything you've worked hard for. And it, you know, it's only rational that I would be rewarded more than this asshole who fucked everything up," right? And I think and this is just going out on a big limb here. But you know, that I think might speak to the critique of rationalism inherent in this film, which is, yeah, the other son's argument is rational. Like, why would you re-embrace him again? You know, he fucked everything up. He did exactly the wrong things in every way with your money. But it's irrational because a father loves his son. And the father is going to open his arms and open his heart to his son, no matter how fucked up his son is. And again, the power of love overcoming the scientific, rational, logical part of humanity. And so that's one way to interpret that. But when you zoom out, he's on Solaris. So he never went back home in the first place. So what does that mean? And that I don't have a good answer, except that, I mean, one possible speculation, and maybe, you know, you can give me your thoughts, both of you. But like, he decides to go inward and stay there. Right. And maybe that's an error in itself. Maybe that's also an overcorrection. Maybe the answer to overextending ourselves outwardly is not to totally obsess and overcorrect and fetishize the inward. Certainly not to stay and be mired in the inward, but is to balance the two out. And I'm not exactly sure if that's true or not, but it does seem that at the end, Kelvin chooses. He could go back. It's made very clear by Schnout that he could go back if he wanted to. He chooses to dive inward and completely give in to Solaris, right? Dive into his subconscious, dive into his inner world, even at the expense of going back to the actual real world. And so, again, that's kind of hard, though. It's ambiguous. I'm not quite sure what to make of that. Those are just some thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The ending is, well, I mean, he does mention to Hari that he's like, "Oh, I could stay," you know, and so it's probably not a satisfying ending. No matter which way we decide that it is. And that's okay. And I think like it would be unfair to assume that when one does the inside exploration that they have a resolve, you know, they could just choose to not even really make anything out of it or continue into it. It is a very, like, I think Lem, the original author of this, I think it was a novel, did not really like this film. because it wasn't science enough for him. And Tarkovsky criticizes that some of it was too sciencey. So they both were not fond of the outcome for different reasons. But I think like maybe perhaps having such an ambiguous ending where we don't, as the audience, don't get to have that resolve is just part of it. That's the human experience too. You know, nothing is linear. And yeah, best of luck, Chris. And hope he keeps the leather jacket.
And it comes back around because, of course, he starts on the farm. He ends up at the farm again, but in a different context, right, at a different level in Solaris. So I think that's interesting. And I just have to mention this because you're right that there's the Lem who wrote the novel, and then Tarkovsky takes it and makes it his own thing. And it mirrors the thing that happened with Kubrick and Stephen King with regards to The Shining. Evan and I were talking about before we started recording. And if you notice in The Shining, Kubrick's kind of an asshole. He doesn't give a fuck. in the beginning of The Shining, as they're driving to the Overlook Hotel or whatever, there's a red car that is pushed off into the ditch. And I believe somewhere, and I'd have to go back, it's just a vague memory, but there's a red car in The Shining, the book, right, by Stephen King. And Kubrick, by opening the scene with that red car crashed on the side as the family keeps going up to the hotel, is his way of saying, like, if you come here expecting Stephen King's novel, you're going to be sorely, you know, discontent with what happens here. I am crashing. I'm taking the bones of the thing. I'm crashing Stephen's red car and I'm doing my own thing. I'm taking it in my own direction. But that's real art, right? They're inspired by a story. They take a story, but their own artistic vision necessitates that they change it. They shift the emphasis. They make something new out of it, as any real artist would have to do. And then the original artist is a little pissed off because it's like, that's not my vision. But Kubrick and Tarkovsky are like, we don't care. We're doing our own thing. Thank you for the source material.
Honestly, I think if the original authors liked it, they did something wrong. You know, like they didn't put their own spin on it. And I think you're correct about the Stanley Kubrick or the red car. I've heard that Kubrick is also famous for just throwing in little Easter eggs that just, yes, you know, you have to watch The Shining dozens of times before you main or like go online to some Reddit and find someone who did it before you. But I like both of your interpretations of the end. I think it's, again, I love these kind of endings where you don't feel satisfied. But I think, again, that also, I think maybe you both said, is that that's the human experience is you may be satisfied in some sense, but then there's always going to be something that takes you, you know, something that comes along, whether it's a financial problem, a social problem, or you lose someone, all of these things are going to come back. So I think they give you that little scientific nugget of we've done something to the planet that's now going to create these islands, but we don't know what's going to happen. And then they're saying like, well, is this him dreaming about that happening? Is he dreaming about the fact that this thing is happening, or is this actually what's happening? And I think at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Everyone is going to have different interpretations of the end. And I personally just find it to be, it's like satisfying in its being unsatisfactory somehow. I don't know how to really articulate that well, but I don't know what Tarkovsky was thinking. There's nothing online. Just like any good artist isn't going to tell you. It's your interpretation of the thing. That was the only last point about it. And I wanted to mention too is the painting that we briefly, you talked about, Brett, the one you had seen in person in Vienna. And I think I had a note about it, is Hari seeing the painting and creating love. And I think it's also just the way her interpretation of art in this movie that is art is almost like this meta kind of analysis that he's almost going for, where she becomes more human by seeing the art that's created by a human. It's all these very cyclical, circular things, starting on the farm, ending on the farm. All these, his wife dies, she returns, and she dies, and she returns. It's just like, you know, the cliche, like, circle of life kind of thing. I don't know. That's it's overall just a masterful movie. Very complex, you can watch it again many times and I think you'll get more out of it. And I like to revisit it again, you know, maybe in 6-8 months, a year, and watch it again and think about all the things that we've discussed. I think that's also what makes me learn more about movies, hearing people talk about them and then watching them and having them maybe influence or understand things differently. So,
yeah, I just want to mention a point you mentioned about Hari looking into the Hunters in the Snow painting or whatever. And yeah, like she could be a stand in for us watching Tarkovsky's film.
Right.
Right. Studying the human psyche, artistic creation as a representation of the human inward life. And yeah, sort of learning more through that process, which we're kind of doing here, right? We're wrestling with these topics. We're now debating ideas of like love and humanity and stuff, which is exactly what a good artist will do, bring that out of you. But have to challenge you. There's no easy answers, just like there's no resolution in life. You know, one thing that I think all of us do, at least I do this, is that we imagine in the future at some point, even though it's vague, that we'll have reached our destination. Like maybe like when in our old age, we'll finally be able to sit back, rest on our laurels, enjoy life. And, you know, and then there'll be some sort of resolution, like the last 10 years of our life are happy or something. But of course, that's not true. Our life is going to deliver us tragedies and unexpected gifts and everything in between all the way up until we die. My grandparents are in their late 70s and they talked to me about this as well. He told me, he's like, you know, don't wait till you get older to live your life. Because this idea that when you're in old age, that work is behind you and now you can finally live, only to find that your body is giving out. You don't have the energy to do anything. You know, he's like this whole idea of golden years and a happy life at the end of retirement. He's like, this is an illusion. And I was like, I took that very deeply. He would know. He's 77 years old. And that sort of inspires me to try to make the most of my life right here and now, instead of waiting for this future point at which I'll finally be happy. I'll finally be content. We're human beings. That point never comes.
And if it does, it takes a very long time. Yes. Like, so
absolutely.
I do appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, like, well, and obviously our generation, retirement.
Well, what's that?
Yeah. Not.
Yeah.
I don't even
have
a savings account talking about retirement. Oh, fuck.
I know.
I don't know. Do either have any last thoughts on the movie? And
my last words are just one, thank you both for allowing me to come here. It's a really great discussion. And I actually kind of want to do this again. Like, now that I'm into Tarkovsky, it'd be really fun. Maybe in like the spring, we could do another Tarkovsky film and maybe do it every season. I don't know. I'm maybe getting ahead of myself, but I would love to revisit Tarkovsky with both of you and then like see, as we watch more and more of his films, what we can continue to extract and glean from what he's trying to do as a filmmaker and as an artist. But so thank you both for having me on. Hopefully we can do something like that. But to the listener, I would just urge you to wrestle with the film like this. You know, be willing to have that ambiguity, to sit with not knowing, to watch a film that is challenging, that you don't fully have answers to. All right. I think this is an interesting thing to do. Like reading a challenging novel, it brings something out of you. It connects you in the moment. And it's much better way to spend 3 hours of your time than just scrolling on your phone, which is just lost time. Like, can anybody listening tell me a time where they spent 3 hours scrolling through their phone and something deep and important happened? Your memory doesn't even remember it. Your mind throws it out as ephemeral nonsense. So we waste our time doing these things. And if you're going to sit down and do something for 3 hours, make it a Tarkovsky film.
Yeah. No, I would love to like visit the Stalker and Ivan's Child and go through those, because I think as you start going through them, you probably, as you mentioned at the very beginning, Brett, you went through like a Hitchcock phase or a Kubrick phase. As you watch more films from these great filmmakers, you'll learn about their styles, the way they do things. You'll probably learn things about this movie that we didn't think of as filmmakers evolve. We're evolving as all of these things, as the, you know, these cliche things. But I don't have anything left. What about you, Amanda?
No, nothing. I would absolutely be honored. I would really love to do a whole series on Tarkovsky. I do need to watch some more of him. Unfortunately, like the class that I took on Soviet history was mostly just focused on propaganda or narratives, which was great. It's a good base, but I do really appreciate having more film that is more art focused, with, you know, historical context, of course, within that. This film was extremely, even though it's not originally his story, Tarkovsky's story, he made it so very personal to himself. And I really appreciate that kind of filmmaking. So I look forward to doing more and see how he developed over the years. I think this is was his one of his first films, or was it his first film?
I think it's his second film. I've closed the
third, maybe somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, it's early in his career.
Earlier.
And just for any, also for listeners out there, you can watch just about every one of his films and most Soviet films on YouTube for free. You can find most of these contents out there just because they've passed the, you know, what is it? The copyright windows of these kinds of things. So it's very accessible. These movies, maybe not the most accessible. It's not like watching your newest Marvel movie, which just, you can turn your brain off and go through just like you would scrolling your phone for 2 hours. And
exactly.
I too, you know, there are times where I'm not going to lie. It's nice to turn on a movie that doesn't mean a whole lot. My kids like to watch those kind of movies and I watch them with them, but to really sit and think about these movies, I think really brings you just to a next level and just like your movie watching experience. And if you're, whether you're a baby leftist, a Marxist, anarchist, whoever listening, I think you can get a lot out of this movie in particular, you know, if you're willing to open up your mind to it, I think so. But yeah, I think I don't have anything else. And I know I mentioned, Brett, your podcast. I don't know where, if you want to tell everyone, for anyone who maybe is listening who doesn't know who you are and your podcast, if you want to quickly just tell everyone.
Sure. Yeah. You can find everything I do politically at revolutionaryleftradio.com. That's the flagship Rev Left Radio. Red Menace, where me and my friend Allison focus on theory and reading texts. And we're also going to do an interesting little series on the German Revolution coming up probably in late spring, early summer, because that's a fascinating part of history that I think, even as a Marxist, a longtime Marxist, I don't fully comprehend the dimensions of the German Revolution and the consequences of its failure. But it's something that we should all sort of wrestle with, because we're still living with the consequences today, as we can see with Germany's support of Israel and all the chaos that ensues from that. And then my other podcast is like a secret hidden podcast, has nothing to do with politics. It's one of those shows you can listen to get your mind off politics. It's like juvenile humor with my old buddy from high school. We also talk about mental health, and he's in active recovery and relapse mode with regards to his alcoholism. So we're on a journey together where he's trying to get sober and, you know, has a lot of deep insights into his struggle with alcohol addiction. We also interview people, just people that are in the local area willing to come into the studio here, which is just a little shed in my friend's backyard, where we interview them in person about their own struggles with addiction and mental health. And I think it's hopefully funny as well as, you know, inspiring and informative show that is something very separate from my political work, but I still think complements it if you're so interested. That's Shoeless in South Dakota.
Yeah, I enjoyed the one on that about where you just shit talk Bill Maher for a good hour. Everyone, yeah. and then Amanda, you can find your content on all the socials too, which I'll link down below. And but yeah, I think we owe it to the to people to come back, you know, months from now and discuss some of the other films. I learned things about this movie that I didn't even consider, so I found this to be really fascinating and very enjoyable. And anyone out there can follow this podcast, and wherever you're listening now, you can like and subscribe. And if you're not listening to Rev Left, you should go back. You guys have, I don't know how many years of content, but just, you know, I just as thoughts as the Che Guevara episodes you did and some of the ones early. I think that was maybe one of the first episodes. I don't even know.
Yeah. First
all
year.
Great content to listen to. And we will catch you in the future for another installment of, I think, Soviet Film. Thanks, everyone, for listening.